Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Columbia University Press has just released a new translation of a work by philosopher Alexandre Kojève, simply titled Atheism, and translated by Professor Jeff Love. Considered to be one of the 20th century's most brilliant and unconventional thinkers, Kojève was a Russian emigre to France whose lectures on Hegel in the 1930s galvanized a generation of French intellectuals. Although Kojève wrote a great deal, he published very little in his lifetime, and so the ongoing rediscovery of his work continues to present new challenges to philosophy and political theory. Written in 1931 but left unfinished, Atheism is an erudite and open-ended exploration of profound questions of estrangement, death, suicide, and the infinite that demonstrates the range and provocative power of Kojève's thought. Ranging across Heidegger, Buddhism, Christianity, German idealism, Russian literature, and mathematics, Kojève advances a novel argument about freedom and authority. He investigates the possibility that there is not any vantage point or source of authority, including philosophy, science, or God, that is outside or beyond politics and the world as we experience it. The question becomes whether atheism or theism is even a meaningful position, since both affirmation and denial of God's existence imply a knowledge that seems clearly outside our capacities. Masterfully translated by Jeff Love, this book offers a striking new perspective on Kojève's work and its implications for theism, atheism, politics, and freedom. Jeff Love is research professor of German and Russian at Clemson University in South Carolina. His publications include books on Tolstoy, Heidegger, Nietzsche, and Dostoevsky, as well as a translation of Friedrich Schelling's Philosophical Investigations into the Essence of Human Freedom. He joins me today to talk about Kojève's atheism. Hello, my name's Carrie Lynn Evans, and you're listening to New Books in Secularism, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, my guest is Professor Jeff Love, who's agreed to talk with us about his new translation of Alexandre Kojève's 1930s work on atheism. So, Jeff, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
First, I want to start by asking you a bit about yourself and how you eventually became a translator of philosophy, because I understand you started out with corporate law in Canada and then took a detour into Russian literature, and this isn't the usual bio we get to hear about on this channel, so please do tell us your story.
It's an aleatory story, I suppose. I'm on my third country now, since I lived in Canada for 30 years, 20 years in the U.S., and I've been here for in Lisbon and Portugal now for, I think, 3 years. You're correct. I was a philosophy major in undergrad. My father, being a good Scotsman, thought that that was a career that was destined to get me absolutely nowhere. So I managed to convince him to be nice with me and to talk with me by becoming a lawyer. I never really wanted to be a lawyer, and I was corrupted in my third year of undergrad when I read War and Peace on just, I don't really know why, but I read it, stayed up for basically a week and read the whole thing, and thought that someday I might be able to do something different than to be a lawyer. And I worked for a very big law firm in Toronto, about 400 lawyers, very interesting people, but I didn't like it at all, never liked it. And like so many of the people I worked with, I wanted to have I wanted to do something different, and luckily I managed to. It was a rather unusual thing to move to study Russian literature, and I went down to the States to study Russian literature in New Haven. I worked for a number of years as a professor. Well, actually, I went to, got a job that because there weren't a lot of jobs in that area in a German-Russian department, and I also happened to speak German because when I was a lawyer, I had learned German, and I'd worked in Berlin a lot, and it's a complicated story, better not to talk about. And but so I worked in both those areas in the States and translated I did a different thing. I did two monographs on Tolstoy. I translated a really fascinating monograph by Schelling with a colleague of mine. And then I moved sort of on to Russian philosophy, more Russian philosophy, particularly Kojève. And so, and then I met this Portuguese writer years ago. He's a very important novelist, Antonio Lobo Antunes. We got along very well. He invited me here. And I still have a research position at my university, but I now work full-time here and I work with him. So there you go. Too many words for a sort of a funny path through different languages and different disciplines, if you like.
Ah, no, that's great. So maybe next tell us how you came to write this particular book.
Well, as you know, Kojève is a pretty fascinating figure. Should I give a little bit of background just on...
Certainly.
Put the book into... Okay, because Kojève is he's a figure who, out of some sort of romantic novel, because he was born in 1902, died in 1968, and had many career changes, one might say. He was born into a very, very, I guess, a family of the high bourgeoisie in Moscow. His uncle was the painter Vasily Kandinsky. He fled Russia the Soviet Union then in 1920. He'd been imprisoned in 1918 for selling things in the black market, so forth and so on. He didn't see much of a future for himself in the Soviet Union, so he fled, went to Germany, and lived in Berlin. He had taken, I don't know how many, apparently his mother's jewels, and sold them in Germany, and invested in the famous company, you know, La Vache qui Rit, the cheesemakers. And he made a great deal of money there, and he lived a very high life in Berlin for a number of years. But was an interesting fellow, because he went finally to Heidelberg, and he went to study. He studied very eclectic, very interesting. He studied Oriental religions, Sanskrit, Tibetan, and Chinese, as well as philosophy proper. He ended up going back to Berlin. Then he went back to Heidelberg, got his PhD on a Russian philosopher, and he got that PhD with under Karl Jaspers. Then he moved to Paris, and when the French stock, he lived in 1926. That is when the French stock market collapsed in 1931. He didn't really have much to do. He had spent time learning modern mathematics and quantum physics between 1927 and 1929. So this is a guy, for just in the 20s, who showed this tremendous interest for Eastern languages, for Buddhism, for Taoism, studied all those, a number of different religions of the East, as well as quantum physics. He ended up writing a 300-page dissertation or treatise on quantum physics, which is very, very interesting, very good. Was accepted by the Sorbonne, but he also showed a pronounced interest in Russian religious philosophy. And he met a friend, a very famous Russian, Alexander Kuare, in Berlin. It's a great anecdote, but I won't tell it because it's a bit salacious too. Anyhow, they got along well. And Kuare was going to Cairo in 1933, so Kojève took over Kuare's course on the religious philosophy of Hegel. And that course he took over, he ended up keeping from 1933 to 1939. And he mesmerized a generation of French intellectuals by his lectures on Hegel's phenomenology. And it made him very, very, very famous and very, very influential. You can imagine Georges Bataille, Maurice Merleau-Ponty, Jacques Lacan, Raymond Aron. It's a who's who of the French intellectual culture of the interwar period, who were his students, who were mesmerized by him, and by all accounts, he was a very charismatic human being. He did various things during the war. Probably worked in intelligence services, maybe for various sides. Who knows? And after the war, he didn't want to return to teaching his seminar. And one of his old students, who was Robert Marjolin, who was very powerful in the French government, hired him on to be an advisor in the ministry, in one of the economics, ministries of finances, pardon me. And Courgève, after the war, exerted this enormous influence in the Ministry of Finances and the French government. He is one of the architects of the European Community, of the founding treaty of the European Community. And there are anecdotes about this part of his career, which lasted until he died in 68 in the midst of a speech in Brussels. They abound. For example, he negotiated GATT. Here's your philosopher, your religious philosopher, your a man interested in quantum physics in Eastern languages, who becomes a master negotiator of GATT. And one of his students told me this funny story, and I'll get to the point just after this, but it's a classic Courgève story. So they're meeting, they're having a large meeting of the various delegations to discuss details of the GATT Treaty. The Germans come in, they've got 10, 15 assistants. English have a group, all the different people have staff, and a number of underlings and so on and so forth. And there's Courgève by himself with a few cards representing France. And of course, he had a fantastic memory. So he ran everything with just these few cards. And you can imagine the effect that it created on his on the other parties. And this was typical. He was feared. He intimidated everyone. He's incredibly inventive with arguments and had by all accounts, Raymond Aron, for example, who knew Sartre, who knew a number of other all the stars of that era, said the most intelligent man he ever met was Alexandre Courgève. So let me go back into the 30s just to introduce this. I got interested because one thing I haven't mentioned is Courgève only published, well, he didn't, he barely published anything in his lifetime. The book that he became well known for, which was the Hegel Lectures, was published after the war by one of his students and at the behest of one of his students, as was a later book. He didn't publish and didn't like to publish very much, and he left an enormous number of things behind. One of these was Atheism, what the book came from. It was a manuscript that he wrote in 1931. And it's an unfinished piece of work, obviously. It seems to have changed while he was writing it. But it's just, I just came across the French translation of it and got fascinated by it and wanted to go back to the original Russian. And I noticed the original Russian was different and there were parts that were not, that were done a bit differently in the French and some parts that seemed to have been dropped in the Russian transcription of the text. There was an official Russian transcription as well. So I just went back and I think it's a remarkable argument. So that's how I came to it. I also wrote a monograph on on Courgève. So this was part of that bigger project that covers a lot of Courgève's thinking and covers most of his career and particularly some of the Russian roots of his thinking. And this particular document fit into that very, very nicely because for one thing, it's written in Russian. And it's written in an interesting Russian, and it has classic Russian themes that are cliched Russian themes of the god-haunted Russian intelligentsia. So it was a bit long, but that's...
No, that's fascinating. Yeah. So I take it this is the first English translation ever this work. Okay. Wow.
And it's the most complete. I mean, there's another one in Italian. But it's the most complete of all of them because there are parts that were dropped in some of the, and the manuscript is very hard to read. His handwriting is atrocious. So I understand and sympathize with anyone who had to read it and go through the manuscript with changes and things of that nature. So it purports, and I think is an attempt to be the fullest and completest translation in any language right now.
What a fascinating character. Wow. And you were working from handwritten material.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, his handwriting is like looking at the a squiggle.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Well, let's turn to the article itself, and we'll start with the basics. For the sake of his analysis, how does Courgève define God, the atheist, and the theist?
Okay. I think a central thing to come to, first of all, is obviously Courgève realized that if you're going to talk about atheism, you have to talk about theism, and you have to talk about God. First of all, and the first great question he asks is whether you can ever, the guiding question he starts out with is, can you have an atheistic religion? and uses Buddhism as an example, but he suggests that's the ostensive guiding line of the entire treatise. Can you to explore the idea of an atheistic religion? The background of that is probably Heidegger, but we can come to that later. But in terms of God, yes, the crucial, and what's fascinating is a philosophical attitude towards God. It's not looking at the theological conception of the personalized God or something of that nature. It's a very detached idea of looking at what God can be, and he separates out two notions of God. And two different kinds of believers, or he calls theists, and uses an awkward term. One is a qualified theist, and another is unqualified. So someone could say, well, what does that mean? What he means is a theist who, when he says an unqualified theist, a theist who believes in a notion of a God that is simply an is. There's no predicates that you can apply to that kind of God. There's no human descriptions that could be applied to that God. It's simply that sort of theist at the most basic level says God simply is. Can't identify what God is, but God is. So he calls that the unqualified theist. The other theist is the qualified theist, who gives an identity to God. God is a what of some kind. Which means that certain predicates apply to God. God can be great, God can be this, or God could be powerful, as you know, all powerful. And then Kojève asks, well, if we can apply certain predicates to God, in what way can we do so? That's of course a tremendous question. And these are as you are well aware, fundamental questions of the identity of God, because as you know, if you go back to the Middle Ages, there's the three different kinds of ways of looking at God talk. You could talk about God by analogy. Somehow you can use a predicate, and it can be that refers to a human state of affairs and can be used analogously of God. This would be Aquinas' position. There's equivocal predicates, which can be applied to God in one way and a human beings in another. And there's univocal predicates, which means, say, being, this is a famous thesis of Duns Scotus, that being somehow is shared by God and human beings, but there's a different intensity. In other words, God is, to put it really crudely, you could say infinitely more being than us, or there's a different intensity of that. Kojève alludes to all those sorts of things just by talking about the theists, these two different kinds of theism, which gives you a sense of the economy of the treatise and how erudite he is and how lightly he moves with his erudition. And of course, opposed to these two theists is the atheist. But that's the first setup. It's a question about what exactly God can be. How can we possibly talk about God? Or can we talk about God? And these two different entities that talk about God. First, the theist, who's the unqualified theist, and the qualified theist. And then, of course, the other entity will emerge is the atheist. Anyhow, I hope that gives starts us out anyway with your question.
Yeah, it does. And you mentioned that he uses the device of two characters with opposing views, one an atheist and the other a theist, in order to elaborate on the logical consequences mm-hmm. of the seemingly contrasting worldviews, which I think he concludes are not as contrasting as they may appear. So what do we learn from this exercise?
Okay, well, what he'll now do is quite fascinating. And he'll develop... To try to explain, the questions he comes across, first of all, are how do you, if you have the theist, the so-called unqualified theist, who simply says God is, without any predicate applying to it, how do you differentiate that theist from the atheist? Because if you can't say what God is, you can just say God is, how do you differentiate that really from saying that God is nothing? God is, or God, or how do you say you can't even give a predicate of God is nothing, or God is, but how do you differentiate the position of the unqualified theist from the atheist? And the same applies to the qualified theist. If the qualified theist says that God has certain human qualities, or qualities that we can extrapolate from our own experience to God, is God still God? Is God, and underneath this, the real question that you'll come to is God completely transcendent? Such that you can simply, the only difference between the believer and the non-believer is the believer says there's a God and the non-believer says there's not. but rationally, you can't make, it's hard to make the distinction. Okay, so that's this notion of a completely transcendent God, a God who would virtually be the same as nothing. And this is no idle matter, because in fact, you'll have a school of thought going from Luther and Hegel, who says that Luther already declared, I mean, Mark Taylor says this in one of his books, that Luther declares already in one of his songs or hymns that God is dead, because in a sense that God is so infinitely distant from us, or so distant that it's hard to make the distinction between, the distinction between whether God is or is not is a difficult one, or is it even relevant? Okay, so you have that. Then you have the question of if you have God too personalized, is it still God? And so you have this identity issue. Now, Kojève does, it's fascinating. So you have the transcendent idea, and then you have the idea of God being somehow imminent in the world, or somehow with us, somehow fitting. And the atheist, and so what he develops to differentiate or to work out this problem or to set up a series of experiments is this notion of what he calls the human being in the world and the human being outside the world. Now, what's really fascinating is here is, first of all, he sets up an outside. He says both a theist and the atheist posit some sort of outside, whether it be the God who's completely transcendent or a God who's sort of super great being, something somehow differentiable from a human being in intensity or of something of that notion. And the atheist has to do the same thing, because the atheist has to say, in some sense, to be an atheist, that there is no God. So the atheist has to say outside of the world, there is nothing. Both the atheist and the theist, either kind of theist, have to posit some outside. And that's where he uses this wonderful device, this human being in the world and the human being outside the world. His two heroes for the while. He says, then he develops his argument a bit further from that. I don't want to anticipate too much because I've talked too long already. So maybe you can, if you want to jump in there and ask a question or.
Yeah, well, my next question has to do with bringing in Heidegger. I guess as I'm following along with your explanation, he seems to be suggesting that the atheist, in a sense, has to make his own decisions about defining the terms of what a God would be before asserting that he doesn't believe in it. Well, sense, making some of the same assumptions that the theist does.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think that the primary. Well, there's two things where Heidegger comes in clearly. Obviously, the guiding thread I mentioned earlier when I said, is there an atheist religion, is a snipe at Heidegger.
Okay.
Heidegger creating a religion of being. And Kojève wouldn't be the first to make that comment. But there's a notion that Heidegger, and of course, Kojève would claim that Heidegger is what he would call a theistic atheist. Meaning that Heidegger does not put for Heidegger, there's something that's always outside of where we are at a given moment, or outside, or there's a surfeit of possibility, or whatever have you. He's always positing something outside, so for Kojève, I think there's this notion that Heidegger has. It's a common notion that that Heidegger has sort of created a negative deity or a something that's very similar or performs the same function of the deity, but is not a deity in the sense that doesn't have all the afflatus of the Christian religion and so on and so forth. So he's one of the main things he's exploring is that position in terms of what as an atheist and as an atheist. Is an atheist a non-believer or a believer in something? And in terms of where the atheists come from, first of all, as you noted, Kojève says, yes, obviously to make sense of atheism, you have to understand what the privative is about. So you're saying your alpha privative is saying a theist, theism. You have to understand what the theism is to understand what's being negated, first of all. So you're quite, that makes perfect sense. And then he wants to explore the commitments the atheist makes. And how you differentiate those commitments from those of the theist. I'm sorry if that was unclear. I'll be happy to clarify. But
no, that does make it clear. Is there any other extent to which he interacts with Heidegger, or does that pretty much cover it?
I think Heidegger is the main interlocutor throughout the entire treatise. And it becomes particularly evident in his, of course, he uses a lot of language derived from phenomenology in the treatise. And he talks about the notion of interaction, that we're always interacting in the world. Talks about world. I mean, the human being, for example, just the term, the human being in the world is so evidently a sort of ironic gloss on Heidegger's in der Welt sein, or in, being in the world. And instead of calling it Dasein, which Heidegger uses the term to be gender neutral, or and not really to indicate a kind of it's not a human being in the world. Kojève makes it very evidently a human being. Kojev is more anthropological than Heidegger would want to be. And in fact, Heidegger, when he read Kojev's lectures later on Hegel, had that complaint, said, oh, he's terribly anthropological. And Heidegger didn't like that perspective. But that's a side, just a side. But so he uses terms that are clearly derived from Heidegger. He starts his discussion, sure, he's talking about it's framed within theism and atheism, but when he talks about interaction, that the fact that we're always interacting in the world, he says that the estrangement doesn't come from interacting in the world. Estrangement is another Heideggerian term. He uses the words horror and terror, which are derived from Heidegger. They're derived from Heidegger's famous talk given in July of 1929 called What is Metaphysics? Where he talks about angst and the as being different than fear. Fear having a specific object, angst is not having an object, terrifying. Well, that is all clearly fits in within the middle part of the argument of the treatise, where he talks about interaction, terror, and moves to death. And his discussion of death is very, very evidently also tied to Heidegger, because Kojève, and he says this elsewhere, believes that, you know, one of the great things that Heidegger did was to talk openly about death. Philosophers had not tended to talk quite so openly about death, though Plato obviously does, but in the way that Heidegger does. And so Heidegger is in that, or to that extent, is sort of everywhere present in the treatise as an interlocutor and as a sparring partner.
You mentioned that he explains notions of interaction, homogeneity, and estrangement. And you already mentioned interaction and estrangement there, but is there more that you can tell us about these terms or about homogeneity?
Well, yeah, I think he with interaction is first thing he wants to imply. Well, they're very important because interaction is his way of saying we're always dealing with things in the world. And he says that he wants to argue he wants to say that we're comfortable in the world, that we're always sort of working in the world, and that when we see other people in the world, when we see objects, they comfort us in the world, and we feel a certain relation to those things, which he calls homogeneity, really. What is not, when he refers to estrangement or something of that sort, he's talking about the introduction of something that doesn't fit, that we can't interact with in our typical ways of interaction. And he will move very quickly from the discussion of things that we get along with very well to things that terrify us, which ultimately leads to his, I think, probably the most fascinating part of the entire essay, if you like, or treatise, whatever it is. He uses different terms, is the discussion of death. And what he does also is he's connecting explicitly the notion of God with death, because there's a very Epicurean move here. He says it's God is not comforting, it's God that is terrifying. God is, and to think of the outside to the world, which would be God, remember, or the nothing for the atheist, is what is truly terrifying, truly estranging. It introduces something to us that we don't know how to interact with. And of course, the connection with death is fundamental in the entire treatise. Death as something that we do not know how to interact with. Of course, that's a very Heideggerian notion as well, but his way of developing that and his connecting of our notions of God with death is something Heidegger doesn't do quite so explicitly, because Heidegger never does really anything terribly explicitly anyway.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. And so Kojève discusses his thoughts on death at some length and the challenges posed by the circumstance that one cannot experience their own state of being dead, as you say. But he felt as well that, because a lot of Christians will tell you that they find comfort in the idea that they will have eternal life after death. And so his view was that underlying that, they really were experiencing terror.
Well, I think what he'll say is this. First of all, if I could preface it, one of Kojève's, I think, most remarkable statements, I've always found it so interesting, and it's very powerful, as he says in a little treatise he wrote after the war, resurrection, the only serious theological mistake of Christianity. And that tells you a lot about how Kojève thinks, in the sense that, and he's thinking in a long tradition. In fact, I was just having a discussion with a Israeli scholar the other night. We were talking about Job. And famously, as you know, in the book of Job, they have this portion at the end, which we call the reward portion. Job endures all these terrible evils only to be rewarded in the end. And there's this whole sense that you have, that you also have in the notion of resurrection, that one lives and one prepares himself to die with the notion of some sort of reward. For Kojève, he says that's a mistake. And where that works into the treatise in an interesting way is, of course, he does the first thing he moves at, and I think I've had many students who, I used to love doing this, especially in the South and the States. I'd start a class by saying, how many of you all want to die? And I'd have a class of 35 students, 27 put their arms up and say, me, I want to die. So what do you want to die? Why don't you, it's baiting, but if you're so eager to achieve your eternal life, why don't you just die now? Well, some naive student would say, well, I can't because I can't commit suicide, so I got to wait.
Something like that. Really? I'm amazed that the response would be quite that extreme.
Oh, yeah, it stunned me. It really did stun me. And I would ask, and they would say they were very excited, looking forward to their death. And in fact, I can give another, even more amusing story, though it's a pretty dark story. I was at a hospital in South Carolina as well, in a cancer ward, and there were five gentlemen there, all who had spouses or friends who were being treated for cancer, and then they started talking about the rapture. Now, I was sitting there and listening. They talk about the rapture, how they were going to be reunited with their families, with their loved ones in this grand moment of completion of time, which they referred to as the rapture, this sort of apocalyptic view. And they were, I mean, please don't get me wrong. I'm not criticizing. I'm not, and nor am I taking a condescending view. What was astonishing was how powerfully these people believed in that and wanted that rapture, which meant the apocalyptic end of our world, to come about so that they could return to their relatives and all those who had died. It was a remarkable thing to listen to because they were sincere. They were very, very, these were people going through a lot of pain with people very close to them. And it was, for me, it was stunning. And it reminded me of how these students felt. So to take it back to Kojève, Khrushchev's doing something that I think anyone can do. Anyone can sit down and think, what would it be like not to be here? What would it be like to be dead? And in a sense, that's what's going on in the treatise. When he talks about this human being outside the world, and he differentiates two different kinds, he's asking that. Because after all, death is not, how is death in the world? If I die, and Khrushchev makes this presumption, just for the sake of argument, how can I imagine myself as not being, of course? And what is it not to be? What is it to die? What is it not? No, obviously, you could stay with relatives and people that you know who have died. They're not here anymore. Of course, then someone will argue, yes, they are. They're here, there are pictures, and so on and so forth. But physically, they're not there. Well, let's just say they're not there. They're absent. What is that absence? What is that absence from here that is there? So when Khrushchev discusses it in this nice framework, if you like, the theist is the human being in the world who imagines himself or herself as outside the world. The atheist is the human being in the world who can't imagine himself or herself outside the world, cannot imagine any outside other than being an absence of being here in the world. So the vast difference Khrushchev identifies, first of all, is that the theist says that there's some kind of me that is out there that's going to live outside the world. It'll live in God, it'll live as a soul, I'm not sure, but that's how he begins to look at that. And it's a simple, it's very simple structure, but it's very powerful because it puts the question of what is it to be outside? Now, another question you can ask, and I used to ask my students, same thing, because they all want to die. They're all very excited to die. And so I said, so where do you go? And they say, Jesus, Dr. Love, because that's what they'll say in the South. You know where we're going to go, hopefully for good. And some of them thought they were already saved, which is a bit arrogant. And they're going to go to heaven. And I say, okay, well, so tell me, what is this heaven that you'll go to? And it was always fascinating because nobody could give me an answer. Other than some sort of, golf club populated by white people with nice clothing. And, I'm not joking.
I know you're serious. I'm just amazed.
But I would ask, so I said, that's what you, well, you, so you spend eternity in a golf club singing songs or being nice, or doing something. And of course, now with The Good Place, all that's ruined because I can't talk about this sort of stuff. But, it was, so I say, so you're 60 years old, you're suffering terribly. And you've lived your entire life to go to this place that you can't really, you don't really even have a clear sense of where you're going. What does that say? So, not to belabor the point, but what I think is really fascinating about Khrushchev is when we come down to the question of death, the person who projects an image outside the world, as opposed to the person, which is the theist, as opposed to the person who doesn't project an image of themselves outside the world, brings it to very strong relief, the basic issue what is that issue? What is this projection? What kind of life does one imagine in this afterlife? Why would one want that? Why does we somehow create something outside the world, as the theist would do? And on the converse is, the atheist, what is it to imagine oneself as ending for good? As never being, as the beyond being nothing but an empty space. Now, if you are alone at one night looking out and you think of those possibilities, it's quite terrifying, I think. So when he talks about fear and terror, the fear and terror that death bring, I think he applies it both to anyone, to the atheist and the theist, and sees in them different responses, obviously, to how to respond to death. He doesn't judge which one is better, which one is worse, but he puts that out. And what's interesting there above that is that for the theist, how do you explain the concept of this God that holds the human being in the future? What is it? If you can't describe this God, you can't describe, or if you describe this God as sort of a super being, like something out of a science fiction,
what are you indeed doing? So I think he puts those questions, a number of a constellation of questions, or he organizes them in a very effective way and he associates the question about God, about theism and atheism, about religion, as of course everyone has done. And Melville says famously, religion's born like a hyena howling near the grave, which is from Chateaubriand, said the same thing. Franz Rosenzweig, the great, the first line of his book is all thought about his book. He's called The Star of Redemption, a famous book written around the same time, actually, that all thought about the whole, about God, is based in fear of death. So Courgette very effectively winds together these threads and shows what and shows that death is whips us out of this world, out of our world of everyday interactions, and is always sort of there, and that the theist, in fact, does one thing by sort of turning death into something that is more or less similar to what we exist, what we have in the world, and the atheist doesn't do that. Sorry.
No.
Just to...
So am I. We better not stumble over our apologizing to each other. But let's move on to some even more cheery stuff, because Courgette addresses suicide, and he has a fairly radical position on suicide, characterizing it as the highest expression of freedom and the ultimate confrontation with death. And once again, it highlights different perspectives on reality posed by the atheist and the theist. So could you tell us about that?
Yes. I mean, he mentions this. This is a theme that he talks about in numerous places. In Atheism, the particular treatise, he's rather more ginger with it. He has a test of freedom. He says, I can believe myself to be free, knowing that I could commit suicide, but I don't. And he says, this is a sort of test to show that I'm free, because I know I could commit suicide, but I don't. And then he says in a note that, well, nobody would really take this seriously. But in other spots, he's a bit more blunt about it. And I will get to that in a moment. But there's a history to this in Russian thinking. And it goes back to Fyodor Dostoevsky, the great Russian novelist. And in particular to a character in one of his novels called Demons. The character is named Alexei Nilich Kirillov. Nilich, of course, being a sort of play on nihilism. And Kirillov is one of these fantastic Dostoevskian characters that only exist in Dostoevskian and Russian literature, who is an engineer of suicide. And he's planning suicide. And his whole existence is built around committing this suicide as his act of becoming God. Because he says once the fraud will be realized, once he commits suicide, he will be rid of the pain and fear that we call God. God is the representation of human pain and fear. So we create a God as some horrible, in Courgette, God is a figuration of death too. And that is a sort of allusion to this character in Dostoevsky, who, by the way, has a very hard time committing suicide. And that brings me to the bigger point. What Courgette is getting at, and I think it's very interesting and worthy of thinking about. He puts things polemically. He likes to do that. He was always a provocateur. He enjoyed putting on his French interlocutors and knew how to work with them very well. As I said, he was a very seductive personality. I think he's the kind of person who could charm just about anyone. And his argument is this, however. And it's an argument against what we might call bourgeois freedom, the freedom of self-interest. If you look at the modern, I guess, early modern English or philosophy, someone like Hobbes, the idea that society is formed in order to free us of the fear of violent death. Nothing could be a more selfish or self-oriented aim than to be freed of violent death. Nothing could be more selfish than to be free to enshrine the fear of death into a principle of societal foundation, because the fear of death is evidently the most selfish fear, because only individuals die. And indeed, I may, to be mean about it, we all have lost people we love and so on and so forth, but there still is a fundamental difference between watching someone die and dying yourself. One thing that no one can share with anybody else is his or her death. Heidegger says this beautifully when Heidegger says what is most me is my death. What is most mine is my death. Think about that as a parody of the Greek notion of know thyself, gnotis auton. Know thyself when you say, I know, if I truly know myself as what I am death. Kojève said that too. And what Kojève's point is, of course, is that for most of us, self-interest is self-preservation. We spend our entire lives organizing things to enhance and extend our domination over certain things or to maintain ourselves in life, period. And Kojève says self-preservation, which we might call, or the capacity to preserve oneself, to protect oneself, and so on and so forth, to gain wealth or whatever, honors, these are all modes of self-preservation, all selfish. And do they make us free? Because if, in fact, it's our urge to be free of death, it's our animal urge to preserve ourselves, be free of death, are we really free? Is this bourgeois freedom really freedom or the most abject servitude? Servitude and fear of death. So Kojève says, and he's got long religious roots for this, that the true saint, the true nobleman, is the one who most resists self-interest, most resists the temptation to exert oneself over others, to consider one's own life more important than others, to survive. And everyone survives at the cost of somebody else. Sorry, that's the way things are. And Kojève says that thus, when Kojève talks about suicide, what he's saying is the truly most human act is to refute the rule of animal self-interest, as he will call it, or the refute of the rule of self-preservation. And the act of suicide, in that sense, is the most honestly free human act, the freedom from our animality, the freedom to our servitude to our animality, no matter how we might dress it up. And that is what he's fundamentally saying. And it's a much more powerful argument than some people might give it credit for. Of course, Kojève says it in a funny way because he knows people will dismiss it. Because the bourgeois mind's going to dismiss that. It's going to say, oh, I'm fine. I'm getting better every day. All this nonsense that we tell ourselves. Especially now, days when, you know, there's the 70 is the new 50 and 85 is the new 34, or the 110 is the new 90, with this obsession with survival and with extending one's physical, which is all selfish and self-interested. Kojève challenges that and says that human beings, to the extent that we are engaged in the pursuit of self-preservation, are we human or are we beast? And of course, this is a very ancient Christian theme. One of the greatest enemies of self-interest in the modern era is Luther. Now remember, Luther doesn't give you works. Luther doesn't, you can be as nice as you want in the world and you'll never be sure you'll be saved. Luther is one of the most radical opponents of this notion of self-aggrandizement, selfishness, self, which is the individual, the animal wanting to say, I'm going to survive. And he said, is that freedom or is that servitude? That's Kojève's argument, I think, fundamentally. And I think it's an argument worthy of consideration.
I'm not sure I agree with him. I think that there's a role of contributing to community, not to sound, I don't know, trite or cliche, but not that it's your role to necessarily argue on Kojève's behalf here with me, but I think it's a really interesting line of thinking, but I don't know if I agree with him. But
offend the way we think. I mean, sorry.
No.
I mean, there's a history of this in Russian thought, a deep history of this. And there's a deep history of this in German thought, and particularly with Hegel, because there's the sense of how do you then, if you don't agree with that, fine, we understand. But how do you regulate human selfishness? How do you make sure, how do you avoid a situation where, just for example, let's look at the two extremes. The Kojevian extreme, which has got a Christian element, got a Hegelian element, got a lot of different elements, says that I am most myself when I give myself up to the community. When I live for my community, I live for all, and all live for all. Not just me, because if I'm just doing it, nobody else is doing it, I'm getting stomped on. But that the highest human and the human community is where everyone lives for everybody else, in that sense, where the notion of self-interest, in a sense, dissipates, and therefore the notion of authority dissipates. It could be an anarchistic community, as it was in Tolstoy's imagining. It could be a sort of a Greek, a romanticized Greek city-state, where, you know, the famous examples they always list are Sparta, where the mother, you know, the famous story, the mother finds out that her five sons have been killed in a battle and says, and her first question is, but did we win? And so complete dedication to the state, something that is so offensive to our modern sort of bourgeois self-interested mentality that I don't even think we would know how to consider it. And as I might have mentioned, I didn't mention now, but Kojève was also very much, and provocatively so, he called himself an Orthodox Stalinist. Living in Paris, of course, how nice for him. But what he was getting at in his version of Stalinism would be this sort of complete, a state where everyone had given up their self-interest to live together. Because he saw the alternative to that is conflict, never-ending conflict. Now, there's the nice side of conflict, which is democracy, where people sort of discuss. It's the infinite committee, which goes very well in Canada, a country that was founded by committee, after all. So you have an infinite, never-ending committee. Or you have the more wicked individuals, like someone like Carl Schmitt, who says, at some point or another, conflict is always going to break out. Self-interest, either collectively, as in a national group, or an identity group or something, is always going to break out, and it's always going to cause violence. And how do you regulate, therefore? People have been trying to do it for an awfully long time in the modern era. How do you regulate selfishness, self-interest, the notion that my interests are ultimately, I may not say it, and certainly I wouldn't say it because I put the patina of Christian selflessness about it. I would never say that myself's most important, but in fact, most people act that way. How do you regulate that? That's a question that Kojève asked, and I think fits in with what you're saying, and I should be quiet and listen, and please.
No, I think it's a really interesting question coming from somebody who's who was living in a time in a socialist country where that is the defining characteristic of their ideal, I suppose.
It's a Christian ideal as well. Christians don't go around saying, they don't go extolling selfishness. So it's a very deeply Christian ideal. Kojève, who was schooled in Buddhism, also understood that the sense of, he has a remarkable text, a later text on Kant. And I thought, and something that will just fit in with our discussion, but has always struck me, is he talks about this notion of the Buddhist sage. And what really, and he said a Buddhist sage, and in fact, this would apply to any sage, any saint, as one who appears to be more pious, more ascetic than everyone else. And he says, all that does is hide underneath the ignobility of staying alive and pretending to be a saint. He says every day that saint is appropriating resources to his body. And he's, of course, male, because females couldn't be saints, I guess. But so he says this notion of saintliness is almost parodic, because underneath it is hidden the same urge to live, to survive, that exists in the meanest of characters. And here it's just hidden up, hidden in a more under the guise of being more pious. So that shows you that Kojève basically says there that one can only be a saint if one dies. Hmm. If one refuses self, which is, of course, an absurd position. Yes, I think. But is it really so absurd? So that's, I think, just gives you another sense of how extreme his argumentation is. But it's also, I think, if you counter him, How do you counter him? What do you say? You say, well, we could certainly work through, you know, the arguments, self-interest, well understood. It's a traditional capitalist argument, or we can all learn to democracy is about compromise, blah, 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 you know, those kinds of things.
Sure. All the methods for channeling for good, that personal interest.
Exactly.
But it's still personal interest.
But maybe personal interest isn't so bad after all, then. I mean, I think you have to, I just think it's in this day and age, the kind of argument Kojève is making, it's going to be very untimely. To say you're a Stalinist where we are right now, it might fit because actually Stalin's becoming more popular in China, but definitely in a different way than we might want to understand it. But to make that radical argument is most uncomfortable because it's so against almost all the practices that we deal with every day.
So what I took from the book, too, was that Kojève is basically suggesting that the question of whether or not a personal God exists is kind of moot. Am I getting that right? Because I felt like at the end of the day, he's basically just saying not only can it not really be known, but that the difference, there's less difference between the theist and the atheist than one might imagine. And I just kind of brought from that this idea that the question of God's existence is just kind of pointless for him. Do you read it that way? Am I getting that right? And also I want to ask you about your own personal response to this work.
Well, I think it's a marvelous question because I think Kojève considered himself an atheist. But again, Kojève was the kind of human, kind of person, kind of man that it would be very difficult to know exactly what he did think. And what I like about this treatise, for example, compared to some of his later work is very, very dogmatic on the surface. The treatise is not. And it's not dogmatic, it's precisely about the issues that you're mentioning. I think he has, what I like about the treatise in terms of, is that it gives due respect to both theist and atheist. It looks at, and it questions what it does. In one way, too, is question, is it possible to really be a theist? And is it possible to be an atheist? It complicates and troubles because if you're an atheist, how can you would have to say that there's no God, there's nothing outside the world, but then you're making a belief. You're in fact believing that there's nothing out there and you have no means to prove that belief. Likewise, as a theist, he says, if you're the pure theist or the unqualified theist, you have no way really of proving that your God exists or not. It's clearly an article of faith. You're saying there is an is that is God. If you're the other theist, who you said, yeah, well, I'll make it a more likely looking God or more rational God or more or a God that I can somehow fit in with to my worldview more. And he says some fascinating things about that. I'll give you just one hint. He talks about the infinite towards the end. And one way of looking at the difference between the unqualified theist or the theist who believes just in some sort of is, God is pure is, and the theist who believes that God has some sort of relation to us is to look at the distinction between two notions of the infinite. One, the quantitative infinite, the mathematical infinite, which automatically, because we can all do mathematics, poses some connection between the human mind and the divine mind. And the notion of the what they call the qualitative infinite, which is much more enigmatic, I think, and suggests a boundlessness that we can't even possibly imagine. Now, when Kojève talks about the theist, those issues are back there, and he mentions them in his notes, and they're there. But he problematizes theism. There's no question about what he really asks rationally is God possible? Does God, as a theist would have to understand God, does it make any sense? Likewise, with the atheist, he does the same thing. To say that there is no God and to say that there's nothing, does that make sense? And I think in both cases, he comes down to saying, I'm not sure if it does make sense. And therefore, underneath the treatise is this notion of what is it in us that makes us posit this other world in the first place? Why do we have to refer to our life in the world by reference to something that is outside of it? And I think that will go back into sort of the notion of we're trying to grasp this idea of what is the place or what is it where I am not? What is absence? When I talk about the absence of a relative, where is that person? I mean, these are very simple things, but I am always struck. The guy I work with right now, Antonio Lobo Antunes, for example, has portraits of family members everywhere, and he'll say, they're with me. I said, but they're dead. They're absent. I said, no, they're never absent. There's nothing that is absent. I said, well, they are living in some sort of... He said, well, nobody lives with absence. Absence is just a presence that's... how do you even know? Absence is present. It's always present. These people are present. But I said, the person is dead. And they're not, you know, all those kinds of things I've already said. But the fact is that death, disease, and disappearance all bring up the specter of some other place, something outside of what we ordinarily deal with. And it forces us into these rather drastic attempts to respond to that absence, which I think Kojève has enormous, nobody would say he's empathetic, but I think he has enormous sympathy for those positions and explores them ruthlessly. The philosophical intelligence explores it as ruthlessly as he can, but his sensibility is there. And I mentioned as a final thing just on this is Kojève, being an atheist, claiming he was an atheist, and very extravagantly so, as he did so many things, loved and was deeply and deeply admired theologians. And one of his very best friends was a theologian, a Catholic theologian. And he said that he always enjoyed spending, he to professors and academics, he always preferred the company of theologians and priests. It says something about him.
That is surprising.
He had enormous respect for them, as do I, actually. Because after all, they are dealing with serious issues that most of us probably hide from ourselves.
Fascinating. What an interesting guy.
He is a fascinating guy. And he's dealing with fascinating guys who dealt with those quite like Heidegger and Hegel. But anyhow, I go on.
Well, finally, let's talk about the art of translation itself. How would you define your goals in translating a work like this? And what were some of your biggest challenges with Kojève?
Translation, of course, by definition is, I understand the standard, the cliche now, the humility topos is always translation is impossible. Right? So, I'm not a translator, actually. Basically, most of the work I've done has been on literary scholarship or philosophical scholarship. But for some reason, I ended up translating one treatise by Schelling. I translated a novel by Lobo Antunes, and I translated Kojève. So three different languages, but all related, German, Russian, and Portuguese. But different genres, one a novel. The treatise is written in a very unusual style, Kojève's treatise. And of course, I have to say, an outstanding example of German prose of the first part of the 19th century with Schelling. And what do you do? It is true. Translation is pretty much, if you want to talk about some things, especially the music of the language and so on and so forth, which can be very important, it's virtually impossible in some places. And yet, I think as someone who's read a lot of translations, how is it that there are books like War and Peace, there are other books that come across in about every language I've read them in. So there must be something there. And so I try to convey to the best I can a fairly literal version of the original. Now, literal, of course, is extremely, translation is an academic discipline. So there's with academics, it's always the same thing. It's like 10 dogs, trying to bite the bone off a small animal. So if you say translation is literal, you know someone's going to come out and say that. How can you mean literal? That means there's got to be some faith to an original text that you don't know is there because there's no third person to judge, right? So between languages, who's going to tell me that my understanding of language B is right when I have to deal with the people in language B when there's no C who can judge, no third? So I get that. So what I just try to do is take the syntax of the original language the best I can do and convey it, and the words convey them the best I can in English. So that would be called a literalist approach. Some people would say it's terrible and awful. Other people would praise it. But I like to put people in a position that if they know the language, or even or if they don't know the language, pardon me, or if even if they know it moderately, the translation can help them in either way, to have some sort of what I would say accurate transcription of the original with all the flaws that that may imply. Now, on the bigger side with Kojève, this particular work was extremely difficult, but extremely interesting as well. Because one thing Kojève does, of course, the terminology is fanciful because he's playing and parodying Heidegger, who uses a lot of Heidegger's an extremely, extremely different author to translate. He's almost untranslatable, and he makes himself so because he Heidegger uses certain aspects of the German language and pushes them to their hilt and makes it almost you almost have to learn German to move into that area, to dedicate yourself to Heideggerian thought, which is not a very generous gesture in my mind. Kojève takes the opposite approach, which would befit a internationalist and someone who's more democratic that way, is he produces in this treatise a syntax of absolute simplicity. He takes some of the great qualities of the Russian language to create almost a mathematical, pure syntactical structure that is actually a challenge to translate, but creates this wonderful, simple logic that I think you could translate into almost any language. So it's a really intriguing attempt to create some sort of what the Germans, I'll be pretentious for a moment, the Ursprache, you know, sort of this original language, I think Steven Pinker calls mentalese, but a sort of a code that can be easily, or at least very serviceably, translated through across different idioms. It's a fascinating experiment and quite the opposite from Heidegger. Heidegger says philosophy speaks two languages, German and Greek, and forget the rest. Right? Well, he's very direct about that. And it that tells you where Heidegger's coming from. And Heidegger's interest in poetry is inherently nationalistic and divisive because poetry is always going to take advantage of the particular qualities of the language, musical qualities, syntactical qualities. But Kojève fights against that, creating a rather plain and ugly syntax in Russian, but it's marvelous in one sense to translate because he's trying to create almost a mathematically ordered language translation matrix basis from which you can communicate from Russian to other languages with relative ease. It's quite fascinating.
Yeah, that's a really interesting idea for the politics behind language usage. Living in Quebec, I've been introduced to all kinds of ideas about the politics of language that growing up in a unilingual area, we didn't, you know, never really crossed the mind. But the idea that you would think ahead to your own translation and the choices that you would make for those ends, that's a really interesting idea.
Well, you have to understand, though, that Kojève was a guy who wrote with complete comfort in at least three languages. Mm. I mean, I've read him in German and French. His French is superb. It's got some awkward characteristics to it just because he learned a sort of snooty Russian private school French. But his German is very, very, is wonderful. And his Russian also can be sloppy, but it can also be quite wonderful. He moved between these languages with complete ease. And I think you'll agree, and you make a wonderful point, when you talk about if you grew up in a monolingual world as opposed to the world Kojève grew up in, which from his earliest childhood was multilingual, it's fundamentally different how you see things.
Mm-hmm.
Fundamentally different. And I think that I don't want to go on. I'm sorry, but it is so important that if you know various languages, your mind is very different from the person who only knows one. And it's and that Kojève would be thinking about how he'd move this treatise into various languages, I think would be characteristic of anyone who works in a series of different languages. I mean, I have an everyday reality where I work in at least, I mean, I'm probably, I live in the English with my family, Portuguese almost all day long outside the family, Russian with other people, German with other people, French. And I have a number. And I live in I even learned enough Chinese because I spent some time in China. I'm familiar with quite a few different languages. And it's just a fundamentally different reality. And you see this in Kojève and this attempt to the flexibility, this way of moving in his argumentation has a lot to do, I think, with the kind of flexibilities that are afforded to someone who has moved through a series of different languages, because you never look at the world the same way, because your world is so vastly different. Pardon me. Hmm. That sounds like a advertising campaign for learn languages.
No, it's good. No, I come to French as an adult. And so the little bit of experience that I have with that, I would totally agree with you. I'd love to be able to speak more languages, but I find at this point, just focusing on French is taking up enough energy. But
well, that's certainly enough, right? I mean, I admire anyone who tries to, because in fact, it was interesting. This fellow I was mentioning to, he was over here on Saturday night and we were talking. He's a translator. He speaks Hebrew and Spanish, Portuguese, German, a few other languages. And we were just talking about, because you hear about these people, Carolyn, they say, oh, yes, I speak 9 languages. And I know from my experience and, you know, having been in institutions, all kinds of institutions with very gifted language learners and people who had a lot of linguistic background, that's utter nonsense. And he said to me, you know, one of the things that's so hard is you might have 3 languages or 4, but it's hard to maintain just 2 even, or just, you know, 1, because you're always struggling with your own language. English, after all, and you're additionally always struggling with another language, always trying to work it through. And it's true, you've never finished. So I understand exactly what you mean. And, you know, if I have to go back and speak French here sometimes, because Antonio, for example, switches from French, Spanish to in a microsecond, and I have to go back and forth through these different things. And sometimes I'm very slow at doing it. Sometimes it works well. But I'm always, always reminded of the challenge. Even after having years of French and knowing all and having spent, you know, having done lots of stuff and I'm, you know, certified in Russian and everywhere you could be, but it's still, you go back and it's difficult and it's always difficult. So it's a really intriguing thing. Anyhow, I apologize for going on again.
No,
another Canadian story.
Yeah, yeah.
Canadian content, you know?
That's right. The Canadian connection, as we would say on CBC.
Exactly.
Well, Jeff, I've taken up a lot of your time. I want to thank you very much for agreeing to come on the show. I think it was a really great, interesting conversation. But before we go, tell us what you're currently working on. You've mentioned your Portuguese author there a little bit. Tell us a little more.
Well, I'll just say, I'll plug then, because he's I just finished a translation of his second latest novel he wrote that came out here in 2017. He spent 3 years in the war in Angola, and this book talks a lot about the war in Angola. It's a very dark book, but he's revolutionized the Portuguese literary language. It's a fascinating figure. And the book is called Until Stones Become Lighter Than Water. And Yale University Press is publishing that book, and it'll come out in the spring. So that's one thing. So I translate that book. So I end up with another translation, but I'm working on a book on narrative right now. And on that deals with Tolstoy and Lobo Antunes and the notions of what we use narratives for. Not just, as you know, there's been a great deal of study in the 20th century about structure of narratives and how narratives work and so on and so forth. And this book is oriented towards a very simple question, which is why do we have narratives in the first place? And one of the things that questions I want to pose in the book, which I think is an interesting question, at least I hope it is how we use narratives to flee the present. To flee what's right, to flee a present that is always sort of impinging on us with such force. And we have narratives going to the past, narratives to the future, all ways of getting away from this present that, for Aristotle, was a nothing or a tonun. All the various definitions, the attempts to define the present, and that's one of the questions. That's one of the leading questions in that book. So that's a book that I will be working on, and I guess I'll hope to finish next year. And there's other projects, but those are the main. The projects at the moment.
Oh, that's really fascinating. The role of narrative for human psychology and just people in general throughout history is a question that's dear to my heart, as I'm an English literature PhD student. But maybe you'll consider coming back to the channel with that book after you've published it, because we do have a channel here for literary studies. So,
well, I would thoroughly enjoy that, and I've been fascinated. Yes, by narrative. I work with a friend who's doing a very interesting book on how the connection between narrative and salvation.
Oh, interesting.
The salvific nature of narratives. This is a Heideggerian point, actually, but it's a very interesting sense of how we build narratives to give us a sense of order and so on and so forth. To give you an example, I mean, from Russian literature again, because I did a lot of work on Tolstoy, but one of the most fascinating things about Tolstoy, who really deals with narrative in a lot of interesting ways, is just that narrative as explanation for things that we otherwise cannot explain. It's a very characteristic aspect of Tolstoy's A War and Peace, for example. The characters do things, they pick up stuff, and they function, and only afterwards do they try to figure out exactly why they did something or what it is via narrative. And they use narratives to make sense of their lives, and the narratives are inevitably kind of direct in a certain way that they often change. Simplify, direct, but as a way of making sense of things, having a salvific aspect to it as well, because you're saved from the sheer chaos, again, of the present, or the chaos of that in fact is our most immediate experience probably every day. And we cut things out automatically based on narratives that we structure, right? Or narratives that we base our everyday life upon that blind us to what's going on. Often not, well, they open up a lot, but they also blind us to other things. So it's very interesting. Yes. Mm. Sorry.
No, I love that. I love that. Do come back for that book. But I will thank you again for being on the show today. The book was excellent, and I'm sure our audience will agree. And I was really glad to have a chance to chat with you about it in person.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Thank you for your excellent questions. And it's been a great, great pleasure for me.
Good. Well, thanks so much. I'll say goodbye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
I want to thank you for listening to New Books in Secularism Today, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Once again, I'm Carrie Lynn Evans, and I've been speaking with Jeff Love about his translation of Kojève's Atheism. If you enjoyed this podcast, please write us a positive review on iTunes, post about us on social media, or tell a friend. The New Books Network is a not-for-profit organization, so all the buzz that you can help us generate goes a long way to supporting this work. I'm also interested in hearing from you about your thoughts on the podcast and the material we cover. My question for you this week is about your reaction to Kojève's work. Do you think he was right about the similarities he saw between the atheist and the theist, for example? Or what about his notion of suicide as a radical expression of freedom? Hit me up on Twitter. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts. You can find me there at Carrie Lynland. That's at CarrieLynnland. Or do you have a book you'd like covered on one of our shows? Contact us through our website, newbooksnetwork.com. Also, be sure to like the New Books in Secularism channel on Facebook and Twitter, where you'll see every time we post a new interview. In the meantime, I'll wish you an au revoir until my next conversation about New Books in Secularism.